You'll open your Bibles to Matthew 18, please. Matthew chapter 18. We're going to be looking at the fourth discourse of Jesus today, which is found here in Matthew 18. We're looking at the. Let me take you back to chapter 13 real quick, just to finish one final thought on the third discourse of Jesus in Matthew 13. This is the chapters on the parables. And we didn't really get to talk about the parable of the dragnet or the, there's one final statement that he makes in verse 52 that I want to just briefly mention, and then we'll go on into chapter 18. But the parable of the dragnet found beginning in verse 47, remember these are kingdom parables. These are parables that say the kingdom of heaven is like such and such. And he's already talked about the parable of the tares and the wheat, explained that to his disciples. The parable of the dragnet is similar, just a different picture that he paints here. Dragnet being that type of fishing where you would take a net and you drag it behind the boat and you're just collecting anything and everything. Okay, you're not out there with a rod and reel. And you're not out there trying to catch one specific thing. You're just going to collect everything that is gathered into that net as you go along. This would have been a very well-known practice there of the Sea of Galilee, which is, we call it the Sea of Galilee, but in actuality it's just a very large lake. And so they look at verse 47, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet that was cast into the sea and gathered some of every kind, which when it was full, they drew to shore, and they sat down and gathered the good into vessels, but threw the bad away. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth, separate the wicked from among the just, and cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. So, the idea is that there's going to be all kinds of good and bad, but the separation between the good and the bad, the judgment and so forth, and God determining who will be in the kingdom and who will not be in the kingdom, that comes at the end of the age. That comes in other words, it's not going to be something that happens right away, just like with the parable of the wheat and the tares. It's going to take some time. God will take care of all that at the end. He asked them, "Do you understand all these things?" And they said, "Yes, Lord." And then in verse 52, he says, "Then he said to them, therefore every scribe instructed concerning the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who brings out of his treasure things new and old." So he's talking about somebody that's now been taught about the kingdom of heaven. He says that person, that scribe that's been instructed, is like a householder, somebody with a house, somebody who has these treasures in his house, and he's bringing out of his treasures both things new and old. Okay, the old would obviously be things that would be familiar to them, things that they were quite aware of, but is Jesus bringing all kinds of new teachings regarding the kingdom? Things that they did not understand? Things that they were not expecting? Absolutely. And so now the scribe has new treasures to share. If you move into a new house, you might have some people over to help celebrate. And if you have people over to your house for the first time, sometimes what people will do is that they will say, "Well, hey, let me give you the tour. Let me show you the house." And you show them these different things, and you show them the rooms and whatnot. Okay, well, think about this householder who somebody is coming over, and he's sharing his treasures. He's showing the treasures. Well, some of the old stuff that he's had for a long time, people probably are familiar with that, but now got some new stuff to share with you. And that's what Jesus is saying, is that I have shared with you and instructed you about some new things regarding the kingdom. All these discourses that we're looking at have to do with the kingdom and trying to teach them really the nature of the kingdom and how it's different than what they were expecting. The nature of the kingdom and the nature of the subjects of the kingdom as well. And so now let's go to Matthew 18, and we're going to see some more teaching about the nature of the kingdom, and specifically as it concerns relationships in the kingdom. And how they are to view one another in this kingdom of heaven, this kingdom that God is bringing. And this discourse is sparked by a particular question that the disciples ask. Look at verse 1, Matthew 18, verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And this first section goes through verse 5 as he responds to this. But knowing the context, knowing their thinking, knowing their mindset, what kind of a question is that? What are they wanting to know about greatest in the kingdom? Think, of course, first century Jew, not you and I in the kingdom today and our understanding of the kingdom, but what would this question have been asking? Okay. Okay. Now you're saying religious status. I would actually disagree with that religious adjective there. Because what kind of kingdom? I mean, while there is, you know, obviously a spiritual nature to it, religious nature to it, you know, and we're dealing with God and so forth, what kind of kingdom are they thinking of? Okay, they're thinking of an earthly kingdom, and so we're really talking about a geopolitical kingdom, are we not? I mean, that's what they would have been thinking of when they asked this question. When you establish this geopolitical kingdom, then who is going to be the greatest? And what do you think that they are wanting to be the answer?
Oh, they
don't. Well, yeah, of course. Now, there's another occasion later on in chapter 20, I believe it is, where somebody's mother specifically comes to Jesus and is asking Jesus favors for her two sons. Do you remember who that was?
Mother James and John.
Yeah, the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, so Zebedee's wife. And what does she ask of Jesus regarding James and John? What does she want Jesus to do for her two sons? Yeah, to sit on the right hand and the left hand. Why that kind of a question? What's the importance of the right hand and left hand in a geopolitical kingdom? Yeah, we have that saying today, that phrase today. A right-hand man is the next-in-command kind of thing, or a very important person in the kingdom, you know, in power and in control and so forth. Left-hand would be very close to that. Okay, so they're thinking, we want to be high-ranking officials in this kingdom. Well, that's basically the purpose of this question as well, is, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? They're trying to figure it out. Who is going to be in these positions of authority and power and prestige? Who is going to be esteemed in this kingdom that you're bringing?
They're thinking human endeavors and yes. Accomplishments in life.
Yeah, they're thinking, Karen says, of human endeavors and accomplishments. And recognition, okay? And so verses 1 through 5, let's just read these verses. Let's continue on and then we'll talk about it a little bit more. So that's the question that really sparks the entire discourse of chapter 18. Okay, but here's the immediate question and answer. Okay, so who then is the greatest of the kingdom of heaven? Then Jesus called a little child to him, set him in the midst of them and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me." Okay, so let's again turn our minds to first century, the ancient Near East, you know, or and what kind of a community and culture they had, and compare that with our culture, because that's going to be necessary to understand what Jesus is saying here. In our culture, children are extremely important and revered and elevated. And all too often, don't we see homes where children rule the roost, where children's ideas and thoughts are more important than parents' ideas and thoughts? And parents just, do you see that in school, Karen? Tanya, do you see that in your classrooms in school? And y'all have to struggle then with authority issues, right, don't you? And whether or not you're going to be listened to. And children have been elevated. Now, please don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. Children have been elevated to a point and esteemed to a point that is well beyond what it really should be. They are down here to a degree. Okay, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying we are to despise little children and that they have no importance or anything of that nature. But there is obviously a vast difference in mentality and capability and wisdom and understanding between an adult and a child. Unfortunately, well, and I'm sure you see it too, don't you? Even in kindergarten, is that the grade you're teaching? Yeah. So, if children are not taught, you know, certain things, then they're just going to think they can take over. This is the exact opposite of the way it was in the first century. Okay. Not only were children understood to be in a completely different plane than adults, they were unimportant in many ways. They were least in society, along with whom else? Who else in the society of the first century would have been considered unimportant? Their opinions really didn't matter. They didn't have a say-so in society. Okay, women, right? And then obviously slaves would be another. So children and women and slaves would have been devalued in the first century. The pendulum has swung too much in the other direction in a lot of ways for all of that. But that's why I believe Jesus calls a little child to him. Now, it says the disciples came to him. Is this just the 12 apostles? Is he using that interchangeably with the 12 apostles? Well, there's some other people nearby. We know Peter was married. Maybe he had kids, or other of the apostles had kids that were there. Maybe they're just in amongst a whole bunch of people, but he's talking with them. There's a little kid, so he calls him over. I don't know. But he calls this child to him, and because a child in their society would have been viewed as unimportant, he uses this child as an object lesson. This child in the kingdom, in a geopolitical kingdom, would mean nothing. What value does a child bring to a geopolitical kingdom? Can it fight in the military? Can it make wise decisions for the kingdom? Can it contribute in some way to a kingdom? Not really. Yeah, a child is completely dependent upon an adult, which plays into why Jesus uses this illustration for a child. So, he calls a little child, sets him in the midst, and says, in verse 3, "Surely I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." When we think in Bible class about the word converted, what do we usually mean when we talk about today, 21st century, conversion, converted in Bible class and sermons and so forth? What's another way of saying that? Becoming a Christian. Okay. But that's just one application of the word converted, right? That's not what the word converted means. I don't know if any of you have one of these or not. Maybe you have had one in the past. Maybe you have driven a vehicle that on sunny days you can push a button and your roof then folds back to the back of the car and you are now in the open. What do we call that? A convertible, because it has been converted from an enclosed vehicle to one that is now open. What's another word for convert, a synonym for convert?
Change.
Okay, that's all it means, is to be changed. I remember as a kid going grocery shopping with my mom, or maybe she would bring groceries home, and she would get Uncle Ben's rice. And what is the word that's on the box, ladies?
Converted.
It's converted rice. And I always wondered myself, what kind of conversion process did this rice go through? Was it baptized or something? You know, I was trying to figure out how this rice had been baptized. What does this have to do with conversion? I still don't know the answer as to why this rice is considered converted. If y'all know the answer, you can tell me after class. But something has happened to that rice to change it. Do you have the answer for me?
I was just going to say, I think a lot of this in perspective is about egos.
Yes.
And when we get older, we form our opinions.
Yes.
And being childlike is being more open-minded. Because adults basically, they morph a child into thinking the way that they should go and don't depart from it. So he's asking the people to change their mind, be more open-minded, and to be a little bit more submissive in their thoughts.
Yes.
That's fine for adults to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are two ways in which I believe that Jesus is saying we need to be like a child. Characteristic is one of them, and I want to play off of what you said there in just a moment about the characteristics of a child. All we need to think about is being changed. That's all the word conversion means. So he says, unless you change the way you are thinking, the way you're acting, the way you're considering this whole concept, not only are you not going to be great in the kingdom, but what? You're not even going to be in the kingdom. So forget being great in the kingdom. Unless you change, you're not even going to be in it in the first place. That's how important this is. This is essential to being in the kingdom. So what is it about this child that Jesus is pointing to that says, you've got to be like this? Okay, so I heard, was it Carol? You just said that. Karen, humility is part of it. Because he does say in verse 4, therefore whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. But let's talk about the word humility here and how Jesus is using that. Okay, as I said, I believe there are two things that Jesus has in mind. One is the characteristics of a child. We've already touched on the dependability or having to depend upon someone else, trusting in someone else. I mean, your kids, especially when they're younger, boy, they really trust and hang on every word you say. And they'll believe just about anything you tell them. I mean, they are completely dependent upon you and they trust you. So that's one aspect of it. And the open-mindedness that was mentioned as well, and being willing to listen to and accept what is being taught. Okay, children are like sponges, and they will just soak up anything and everything. But there's another aspect which I think fits the context even better. I'm not saying that Jesus didn't have this part in mind, but I think really what Jesus is ultimately getting at, considering the entire context of chapter 18, is the social status aspect of it does not exist in the kingdom of heaven like it does in a geopolitical kingdom. In a geopolitical kingdom, a child is nothing. Okay, he is humble in the sense not of character, because, I mean, when you think of little children, they don't understand humility. But they are humble. They have been humbled by society. They're in a humble position. Let's put it that way. Not necessarily humble in character, but they are in a humble position. And he's saying, unless you humble yourselves and make yourselves or think of yourselves as not being more important than others and not looking down on others, unless that's the way you think of yourself and think of the kingdom, you're not going to enter the kingdom. Okay, and I think that that aspect of this illustration of the child and what Jesus is getting at is backed up by the rest of this discourse, because this is all about the relationships and how we treat other people and how we view other people in the kingdom. Okay? Does all that make sense? Questions or comments about that? Sure. So who specifically were these disciples asking the question? Don't know. Don't know if it was just the apostles or others that were there. And I mean, you could imagine the apostles would have at least been part of it, maybe the main ones. But for Jesus to turn to the lowest on the status ladder, on the social structure of their time and their culture, and say, this is who is the greatest in the kingdom, blow their mind. It's not what they were expecting at all. Okay, that's not who you think of as being great in a geopolitical kingdom. Yeah, the endeavor for, or the desire for, the ambition, desire, and wanting to be recognized and so forth, and thinking things through our own methods and doing things through our own ways, and whereas a child who is willing to be taught, like you're saying, that's I believe part of what Jesus is getting at as well, is that we have to be willing to be instructed by God in His ways. And, you know, change our mind, change our thinking about how we approach this. And as one of you were saying earlier, it's hard as an adult, you know, to decide and be willing. Well, we may recognize the need to change as an adult, but boy, it's hard to do so. It's hard to give that up after so many years of maybe a behavior that we shouldn't have been having in our lives. So who's the greatest in the kingdom? He's saying change your thinking. Everyone is important to God, is the ultimate point that he is getting at here, and he's going to continue to then talk about through the rest of this discourse. Sid? Yeah, that may be the case. There are some verses in Scripture that cause me to think that there might be a little bit of a different level. You know, like the apostles are told that you're going to be sitting on 12 thrones and judging the nations. Exactly what did Jesus mean by that? That's up for debate. I can't say that I know for sure. You know, we've talked about, are there different levels of punishment, different levels of reward? I don't really know. But despite all that, even if everybody is absolutely equal in heaven, I think really the main point that what Jesus is talking about is not the full, complete kingdom once that's the only thing in existence and then everybody else has been punished and we are now in the presence of the Lord. I think he's mainly talking about the way our relationships are while we're present here. And that's going to be evident as he goes on through this discourse. I think he's talking about the way we act with each other in the here and now in the kingdom. Does that make sense? As compared to the final days and the equality there, I think he's trying to get across to them that the kingdom, even now, granted, it had not been established yet when Jesus is saying this. He's preparing them for the kingdom. But when the kingdom was established and people began to enter into that kingdom and become a part of that kingdom, it's the way we look at each other and the way we treat each other in that kingdom. Okay.
Is that... In the kingdom as we're now here, you have different levels. I mean, you got the teachers, you got the elders that have rule.
Yeah, you got different roles is what I would say about that, but I would not say that Bruce and Terrell and Paul and so forth are any more important than you or me or JoJo or Ken or anything like that. We're all on equal level there, but we do have different roles and we do have certain responsibilities within those roles. But even still, and that's why the teaching of being a servant to the shepherds, to the elders and so forth is so important to recognize that they are not dictators, and that everybody is on equal ground. And so really what he's trying to get at, I believe, in this whole discourse that's sparked by this question is don't think of yourself as any more important. Don't think of yourself as being viewed by God as better than anybody else. And that's going to change, of course, the way you act with and interact with your fellow believers, the fellow Christians. Does that make sense? Does everybody see that? Okay. Robbie?
Yeah, consider they're looking for a David or a Solomon, too. So,
right.
If you hung yourself like a child, that's about as far away from there as you can get.
Yeah, you couldn't imagine a king on a throne, a literal king on a literal throne, ruling a literal geopolitical kingdom, taking a little child and making that child his right-hand man, can you? That's not at all what they would have been thinking. Okay. So, let's move on to the next set of verses here. Now, he has talked about the little child that he has put in front of him. In verse 6, he changes the phrase to little ones. He's no longer talking just, though, about little children, and I believe the context bears this out as you go along. Really, he's just using this phrase to talk about anybody, any of these people that are in the kingdom, anybody that God would receive. Look at verse 5 real quick before we get to verse 6. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. Just emphasizing the point that Jesus accepts these little children and thinks that those who are unimportant in society's eyes are important to him. And so if I'm receiving them, you need to receive them as well. So again, just changing their thinking on who's great, who's not, etc. But then verse 6, he starts talking about little ones, and that phrase continues on even through this parable of the lost sheep in verse 10. And so you'll see that he's now moving, transitioning from this object lesson of the little child as being the least important in man's eyes to just talking about anybody and how we should view each other in the kingdom. So verses 6 through 35, as it progresses through, is all about God's concern for the lost and how it should also be our concern for the lost. I believe that he's a little bit more pinpointing those who are believers rather than just the general populace of the world and the lost, although obviously Jesus would be concerned with all of those who are lost. He's going to specifically be talking about those who are believers but may be going astray. And so that's going to come up in this section. But God's and our concern for the lost is what we're going to see in these verses. And he's going to start off by talking about causing others to sin. So let's read verse 6 and following. He says, "Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire." Okay, so because everyone is important to God, because God wants all people to be saved, then that is how we treat and what we do with our fellow brother or sister is extremely important also. And we are going to be held accountable for that relationship and what we do. So if we cause a little one, a disciple, maybe someone that we don't think really too much of, we cause that person to sin, then we will definitely be held accountable for that. Our bad example. Okay, question. What time will we stop in class?
3 more minutes.
Okay, what time will we start in worship service?
10:15.
Okay, I was under the impression we were starting the worship service at 10:30. But, okay. Well, then we won't be getting as far as I thought we were today. All right, so our bad example, for instance, or being involved in some sin, another disciple sees that. What potentially can happen with that other disciple? Okay, they might be tempted to join in, correct? Even they might have a pang of conscience about it, you know, they may say to themselves, "Well, you know, I'm not sure about this, but so-and-so's doing it, must be okay," or just don't want to, you know, confront that person, and so go along with it, right? Is peer pressure a real thing even for adults? Yes. Is peer pressure a real thing even amongst Christians and Christian adults? Absolutely. Now, it may not be as bad as when we were younger, but it's still a very real thing, and we have to fight against that. And so, we may be involved in something that is going to cause, as he puts it here, a little one to sin. I mean, you can fill in the blank with all kinds of things, whether it be foul language or going to certain establishments that a Christian has no business going to. You know, just being influenced by others, whatever, you know, modesty, the way we dress. I think that that has a role in this as well, or as an application of this, that it's not just about us, but it's about what we're doing to somebody else and the impact we are having on someone else, the influence we are having on someone else. And while each person has a responsibility, of course, to guard their own minds and their own thoughts, what we do The way we dress, the way we talk, whatever, is going to have an impact on someone else and can influence them. And what does Jesus say would be a better situation than a person who causes a little one to sin? And it uses the illustration of what?
Millstone.
A millstone. Y'all seen a millstone? Big old heavy thing. Can you imagine that being put in your, on around your neck and you thrown into the sea? Yeah, you're not going to survive that, in other words. Okay? All right, well, we'll pick up there next time, so be prepared to talk about the rest of chapter 18.